From SDPB Radio, I'm Josh Heyer, and you're listening to the In the Moment News Podcast. Each week, In the Moment with Lori Walsh brings you news and arts coverage from across the state. Listen live at 11 a.m. Central, 10 Mountain on SDPB Radio, or tell your smart speaker, play SDPB. You can find every In the Moment segment at listen.sdpb.org or subscribe to the In the Moment Segments Podcast. And now, it's your weekly roundup in news coverage. Each week, we welcome medical professionals from around the state to join us for an update on COVID-19. With new information out nearly every day, it seems this is our chance to let a local healthcare leader bring us up to speed, and this week was no different.
Joining us today is Dr. Shankar Kura. He's the Vice President of Medical Affairs at Monument Health. Dr. Kura, welcome back to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Pleasure, Jackie.
So, Dr. Kura, we'll start with kind of the question that we always incorporate into these segments. What do we know today about COVID-19 that we didn't know last week?
Good question to start it off, Jackie. Lots happening with reopening in some of these states. We're seeing some numbers rising. It's kind of early to tell if, you know, these rising cases are a result of new sustained transmission from hidden areas within the state or what, but it clearly indicates that these what so-called non-pharmaceutical interventions are key to keeping the numbers down and preventing the health systems from being overrun.
So when we say non-pharmaceutical, I have a guess what that means, but you tell me for sure.
Yes. So that's just the term that's used in literature. But what it comes down to is the very things we've done to keep the numbers down, for instance, in South Dakota, requiring people to keep that 6-foot distance, follow hand hygiene, stay at home unless you really have to. Go out, venture out, and avoid large crowds. Basically, anything over 10 is a large crowd.
Right. So to that end, we've had continued conversations with protests and other demonstrations over the last couple weeks, but also just the fact it's summertime. People are getting together for bonfires and all sorts of other things, especially with businesses reopening. Talk to us about the role of social distancing and just how much folks need to keep paying attention to this.
Yeah, it couldn't be more critical. We owe it to the community to keep that social distance. Summer, as you pointed out rightfully, it's something that everyone looks forward to, and this is kind of a very social thing for all of us to get together and celebrate things like 4th of July and pool parties and all the other things that come along with summer. I think there was a recent published, done study modeling, basically showing all that we know until now that was published in Science last week, that showed that all the efforts that states have taken to, prevent the kind of gathering of crowds, keeping non-essential services from running, all these have truly helped. And what is also clear in that study, basically a mathematical model based on evidence we have, is these very measures, when relaxed, could result in a second wave. So I think it's very important that we keep that going.
Right. We've heard, at least out here East River, and I correct me if I'm wrong, if this isn't the case out West, but this idea that part of the reason we have lifted, at least in Sioux Falls, some of the business restrictions and things like that is that local healthcare partners say we are prepared to handle a surge of cases. So the reopening of businesses is less about a decrease in risk and more an increase in hospital capacity. Is that the similar case out West River?
Yeah, and that's only part of the plan. All surge plans are contingent on certain numbers, and we have models as well, mathematical models that the state, of South Dakota, in collaboration with the three major health systems, Sanford, Avera, and Monument Health, along with epidemiologist Josh Clayton. Mm-hmm. Together, we came up with this model that we all accepted as reasonable assumptions to make for South Dakota. Based on those, you have numbers that you draw a horizontal line where you say if you exceed these numbers in each of these regions, then the health systems cannot cope and they don't have the capacity. Obviously, we have in the meantime spruced up our supplies, our spaces, and our staff. But you can only push that so far because those were always limiting factors, even in the best of scenarios. Given all that, I think you're right to conclude that we have that ability to handle some of that surge, but how much is the big question. And our projections, based on the accepted model by the state of South Dakota, clearly shows if you remove social distancing, we will be overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. Now, what extent and what degree is anyone's guess, and the models account for 30%, 50% of social distancing and physical distancing, and based on those, you could have at least for West River a maximum census, in other words, number of people admitted to the hospital, of about on the low side about 150, 110, and on the high side you could go up to 800. So that's a huge, huge range, as you can see, for any one prepared to take on these cases.
Right, and that those numbers, 150 up to 800, that would be COVID-related hospitalizations. That's right.
Correct. Thanks for clarifying. Yes.
Yeah.
Hospitalization.
Right. When we talk about social distancing and I know different activities have a different level of risk. I've seen different articles about that. And when we talk about things like 4th of July or the pool parties or something like that, talk to us about the different levels of risk going indoors versus outdoors or what does that kind of sliding scale look like? Or is it all just as big of a risk when you come down to it?
Yeah, I think you hit it. It's all risk. The question is, what are we willing to take in terms of risks? One, deaths, and then two, ability to take care of folks that come to the hospital, which would result in other deaths that could have been, appropriately cared for in the absence of a surge. For that, there's the Princeton Environmental Institute of Princeton University in New Jersey. Published their robust scientific result by a couple of researchers there. Rachel Baker is the lead researcher, and it's basically on the role of climate in the SARS-CoV-2 pandemic. And, summer, usually we say that the pandemic should go down, the virus should go down, but it appears that the susceptibility of the population is a real limiting factor, not the weather. Mm-hmm. So even in hot weather countries like Ecuador and Brazil, which are right by the equator, they are seeing a huge surge in cases. And it all comes down to a immune-naive population that hasn't seen this virus, unlike the influenza virus, which we have seen for at least 100 or more years. You develop a level of immunity. So there is a seasonal pattern that is remarkable. But in the case of COVID-19, that's not the case because we have a very susceptible population.
Wow.
So yeah, the risks are there. And the real risk is we run into is a second wave, like we did in historically from 1918, the Spanish flu. That's what we learned.
Hmm. How soon are we able to tell if we're approaching a second wave versus just kind of almost a plateau of COVID cases?
Yeah, right now we're seeing kind of a plateau. We are kind of not gaining or losing. So in other words, we've reached a peak. And if you look at the East Coast, the big centers, big city population centers and states, they're all, completely on the downward trend and almost back to where kind of the very low numbers. But you're starting to see a rise in the rest of the United States. So, but they are still on the plateau. The difficult thing to predict right now is, will these reopening create a ground for the susceptible in our population, especially those that are vulnerable, to become victims of the disease.
Hmm. Over the weekend, I'm pretty sure it was New Zealand. I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure it was New Zealand where I was seeing videos of folks getting together, big crowds for watching professional sports and things like that, because the country was able to go down to zero COVID-19 cases. Talk to us, how comparable is New Zealand to what we're seeing here in the U.S. or even South Dakota, and how much different are these two scenarios?
Yeah, and those are very different scenarios. An island nation has that advantage. And so, comparing New Zealand is very difficult to the United States. We are unfortunately not as isolated or insulated, if you will, from the world. Those are entirely different. They have successfully, been able to maintain strict lockdowns, and so you don't have any hidden pockets of disease, or because as long as you have someone who is infected, they can infect another person, and that's not possible in a country as big as ours, in a continent that is open. You always will have areas that are continuing to see some form of transmission, and that's why social distancing works, because you are breaking the chain. So as long as you have isolated cases that don't become into contact with a large cluster or group, what we call the super spreader event, is in other words, funerals or any congregation type settings, including sadly our nursing homes, which are congregant type settings, correctional institutions are another example. And these are where you quickly can spread. So if you don't have a large group of people gathering, then these pockets, isolated infections will die out because the virus has no place to go. They can't leap to another human being. So that's what we're trying to do, is break that human chain.
Interesting. I want to shift a little bit. We've been talking a lot about how we're seeing it's not so much the weather, it's the susceptibility of the population. Social distancing is really key because you're not spreading those vapors from one person to another. I know earlier in the pandemic, there was a lot of concern about how well COVID-19 is transmitted through surfaces and folks wiping down their groceries or their takeout or anything like this. What's the new information that we have related to COVID-19 and surfaces? Should people still be doing that?
Yes, surfaces definitely, mainly the high-touch areas. I think a lot of confusion around contact. So the way epidemiologists characterize transmission dynamics of any disease is it by contact or others? So I can say, based on our previous historical evidence with SARS and MERS, which are also coronaviruses, and influenza viruses, which we have a lot more information. These respiratory viruses are, especially the SARS is very similar to this, so is influenza in a lot of ways. The transmission dynamics are simple. You can describe them as contact, droplet, and then in special situation, aerosol or airborne. So main two forms are contact and droplets. So in other words, if you shook hands with someone who is infected, then because their hands might contain their secretions, then when you use your hands to touch your face or any mucosal surface, which is nose, mouth, eyes, that's when you transmit, you sustain that. Contact through surfaces that are low touch. In other words, if it were, like, say, a door handle, that's a high-touch area, a cell phone high-touch. But if you're just talking about a grocery that's been handled by the person that's stocking it and you then pick it up, very low. The probability is extremely low. So still continue to, countertop should be wiped, door handle should be wiped, your phones, those kind of things, and that's why we don't shake hands. The second form is droplets. So someone coughs or sneezes, we then say, hey, practice respiratory hygiene. Always protect your sneeze or cough by either into your elbow or wear a mask. And then the final part, the aerosol or airborne, that's only in very special circumstances, usually in the healthcare settings where we then You know, when we treat folks, sometimes we aerosolize their secretions, intubating or basically ventilating, mechanically assisting their breathing. Those are the instances where that occurs. Very rarely does aerosolizing, unless you're within 3 feet, which is why we say the 6 foot distance, just speaking loudly even or singing, unless you're within 3 feet, it's very difficult for that aerosol particles to get into contact with the mucosa.
Having a newborn child is difficult. Granted, I wouldn't know. But it looks tough. And welcoming a new baby into your family during the pandemic, again, I would imagine, is even tougher. We welcomed on a behavioral health expert with Sanford's Women Plaza to discuss the challenges of having a newborn baby during the pandemic.
We welcome Carla Salem to the program today. She's a behavioral health expert with the Sanford Women's Plaza. She joins us on the phone. Carla, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you. And I'm so glad I got to hear the end of that interview. It was wonderful.
I'm so glad I had a little tissue nearby when the grandma started crying.
Yes.
But what a wonderful way to sort of express that this isn't just an academic conversation. This is people's lives and very personal, individual ways that it's impacting people, and it can be incredibly emotional. Having a baby is an incredibly emotional time to begin with, and now this. What are you hearing from people who you work with? What are the ways that the pandemic is really changing their lives when it comes
to
having babies?
Well, initially, there was a lot more anxiety just because nobody knew what was going to happen by the time they were going to be delivering. They didn't know if anyone was going to be able to be in the room with them, in the delivery room with them. They were pretty certain there wasn't going to probably be the opportunity for visitors, but they honestly just didn't know who was going to be there. So you get kind of the anticipatory kind of anxiety about, you know, now I'm going to deliver. And some of the folks I've talked to have had babies before, some haven't. But as everybody knows who has more than two children, every delivery is usually a very unique experience. You can't really rely on the last one to give you any kind of indication. So there was all of this kind of just very much this anxiety about what was going to happen. And then, I mean, even to the, you know, if you had other children, then all of a sudden, you know, there was no school, so you had a house full of people, and, you know, spouses were together in homes. Sometimes that was good, sometimes that was bad. There was just so much confusion and lack of information and just not knowing, fear of the unknown.
Right. And when we see, you know, news footage, especially in those early days of hospitals in, you know, urban areas in New York City and Italy and beyond, at some point there had to be fear that services might not be available or that there might not be room for things in the hospital. It's kind of terrifying.
Well, I never really heard that. You know, I think people just were so confident that, you know, it's South Dakota and there's always going to be room and there's going to be. And my doctors, I got to tell you, my docs did a wonderful job trying to allay fears and calm people down and making sure that if folks were anxious, they had every opportunity to talk to their doctor, you know, just to get some kind of reassurances. So that was probably at the more of the beginning. Since, you know, more in the last month or so, May, June, what I've heard more is, you know, and I laughed when Brad, the dad, said the advantage was, you know, it was sad that he couldn't share his child with all the visitors, but it was kind of nice to have just that privacy. And after working up on the birthplace here for 8 years, I understand that because there's a lot of folks that, you know, are barely, you know, barely awake and they have a room full of visitors. And it's wonderful because people want to give support and families are great. But there is another side of looking for the advantages of safety measures that parents got a chance just to kind of be together and, you know, understand and get acquainted with their baby. And that was kind of a nice thing, too. So, I mean, the yin and the yang, the bitter and the sweet.
Yeah. What happens after you go from the hospital then? Because now normally those first few days are, you know, so critical at home. still trying to establish a feeding routine? You know, people want to see and hold the baby then. What kind of decisions are mothers and dads having to make once they walk out of the hospital doors and those restrictions are, in effect, lifted?
Well, and, you know, I've been purporting to moms for, 15 years, that, you know, the people that you have for help, use them, and the people that don't probably help as much, you want to, you know, make sure you kind of give them tasks and things and, you know, kind of have some control over that. So that's been something that has been really kind of good, because parents are going home, they're deciding, you know, who can be support people, who can be people that are safe. You know, they don't want, you know, people who are at risk to be around a new baby for both, you know, for both the sakes. So they're kind of being able to be empowered a little bit about who's going to come over and visit, what kind of visits it's going to be. And then, you know, a lot of folks are just doing a little bit of the social isolation. They're getting out of the hospital. They're going to have time by themselves. And there's a lot of folks working at home remotely yet. And so some dads who normally wouldn't have this much time with their the mother and the child are really getting to have some good quality initial time, because you're right, you're establishing routines, you're establishing, you know, becoming acquainted, what cries mean, all of that kind of stuff. So, again, it's kind of been a time of empowerment, you know, as far as deciding how you want that structure to go when you go home.
That's fascinating. Tell me about precautions that people need to take. Is it safe to use hand sanitizer on a baby? Should you? What about other people touching your baby or holding your baby? Are there things that you should do?
I saw that comment that somebody had said if they could use hand sanitizer because people were coming up and touching them. So yeah. I've talked about this with at least 10 mothers during this time about how pleased they were that they could stay at home, that they didn't have to go grocery shopping because they could avoid the experience of people just coming up and touching their pregnant belly, because people do that a lot, and it's very annoying when strangers just come up and touch you. So they were kind of excited the fact they didn't have to deal with that. So I found that question very funny. So hand sanitizers and babies, I think that you have to check that out with your pediatrician to understand what you can do. I think probably what you want to do the most, though, is, you know, get babies in a situation where they're protected, so folks can't just come up and start touching them. So protected environments would be, you know, making sure you're in the social distancing, and if you see somebody coming up or you're having a conversation, make sure that the baby is protected or children are protected, because that is a common happening around here, is people will just want to, they're just so excited about the baby, they're good spirited, but the touching is probably not appropriate, no matter when, if you don't know the person.
And again, that becomes an empowerment moment, because you almost have this built-in excuse to say, don't touch my baby, whereas before, you know, it felt rude. But yet you really didn't want people reaching out to touch them anyway.
And, you know, I think that's been the kind of the fun experience right now, is figuring out how to look for the benefits in all the safety measures that we need to put forth. So, and there are different kinds of benefits. For instance, you know, the question about anxiety, you know, the anxiety that is, you know, you're home, you're maybe more isolated. And that can occur, but I think what happens more often is that techniques that people have used to help allay their anxiety, to help manage their anxiety, those techniques aren't very obvious right now. So if one of the things you did was get in the car and go places and see things, that doesn't seem so evidently obvious, or talking to people or going somewhere. And so now becomes the challenge to take the strategies that have worked in the past and then kind of find how you can do that in a more restricted environment. Maybe it's just getting in the car and driving to a park, or looking around at some scenery, or going out in the country. You're still getting out, but it's not to the mall. It's not shopping. It's not what you're used to. But the actual act of leaving a home and seeing something different can still take place. It's just in a different kind of venue.
Yeah. Are there sort of a group support, you know, classes like there usually are, you know, nursing support classes or, you know, what kind of services are new moms having access to right now? Has that changed?
Well, they're still, through Sanford, they're still having Baby and Me classes. They are, I think they've been on Zoom mostly, but that's a great opportunity to be with other women who might be, this might be their first baby or second baby, and they talk about every topic under the sun, and it helps to kind of normalize people's experience and, you know, kind of find out that, you know, what other techniques people use, and to actually talk to people, you know, and kind of see who they are that you're talking to. So, and then the social media, I mean, there's never been a better time for social media because a lot of folks are finding different kinds of groups to join or people to talk to about, you know, the whole postpartum emotional continuum, because there is a continuum. People will have emotions after a baby, that's for sure. It's just kind of on what, where it lands on the continuum, and folks get that kind of information about what other people are feeling. So yeah, there's, you know, there's things out there, there's venues. It's just not as traditional as it used to be.
Yeah, let's talk about that postpartum emotional continuum, because there are lots of reasons to be anxious right now, whether it's, you know, the changing in the routine or fear about the virus to what's happening in the world. And I've been watching, you know, on Twitter, some Black mothers saying, you know, I just brought this baby into this world and I don't know what the world is going to be like for them. You know, some other mothers just sort of panicked about the way the world is right now. And that might be tied into that postpartum continuum. It might be a completely separate reaction. So let's talk about that for a minute, if you would, Carla.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point, is the intensity, the amount of perseveration or not being able to let go of a thought, or just the, you know, sometimes irrational thoughts when your cognitive brain says, I know better than this, but you still are just thinking on it. So that's the chemical piece, postpartum. So there is brain chemistry change after you have a baby, and honestly, it takes a long time to restore, up to 2 years restoration. So you could have, you know, more moodiness that, you know, your mouth is going and your brain's going, why are you saying that? And that's definitely a disconnect when that happens. And the intensity of anxiety, where it can be almost paralyzing, that those are more tied into the biology of brain chemistry postpartum. And those are just things that folks can, you know, learn more about if they feel like their symptoms are, you know, a little bit more extreme or affecting them. I oftentimes there's two reasons I see a lot of folks, and that's, first of all, someone in their family, usually their significant other, says, you know what, you're just really kind of, you know, irritating and irritable a lot. Maybe you should go talk to somebody. Or women are just stunned by them, you know, being more irritable with their children. And those seem to be two of the things that folks come in on, because those are game changers. They don't feel right and they want some help. They want some answers and they want some help. Now, the other thing that you talked about, the cultural kind of where the world is going and that kind of thing. And I've talked to women also in the last 2 or 3 weeks who have just been devastated, who have children who are Black or have some kind of, you know, something that they feel might be discriminated against later on in their life. And that kind of anxiety, if it kind of stays with that topic, is pretty much more situational. And we talk about ways that they can, you know, and have power over that, ways that they can educate their children, ways that they can impact, you know, leaders and laws. And so we talk about, again, empowerment, because anxiety that can't go anywhere, that is just there and you can't do anything about, can really become quite out of control.
When do you know you need help? Is it, go back to what you said earlier about, you know, someone around you says you better go talk to someone? Or, I mean, are you going to know, are there warning signs that people should really look for, maybe especially from a distance, if you're not in the house and don't have contact with your daughter, for example, what kind of questions should you ask about how they're feeling to decide whether or not you should encourage them to get some help?
Well, I think people eventually can figure out. I think every woman is going to try and just do it on their own. If they have no history of depression or anxiety, they really don't know what's happening, and they're just going to do it. And you just got to let people do what they have to do. You know, you can't, you know, intervene and say, no, you need to do something, unless you feel like it's a danger to them or others. And if marginal emotional responses, people will try to, women will try, especially, to just kind of power through it. And I hear women all the time say, well, I thought it was stronger than that. They kind of parallel strength with biology, and I really try to show the difference. You know, the biological piece is very strong, and chemistry is not usually controlled by cognition. If it was, there would be no disease. We would, you know, regulate our insulin. We would regulate cell division. We would do all of that. But this is the biology piece of postpartum is just not able to be controlled. So people will try as long as they can, and then when they don't feel right, if they feel like they're not being a good parent, or if they feel like their spouse, their relationship is suffering, or sometimes they've even gotten back to work and there's employment issues, that's usually when they come to the realization that I've tried everything I know, it's not working, I probably need something else.
Each Wednesday, we invite people who are addicted to politics. We call them the political junkies. Enjoy.
Let's bring in our Dakota political junkies for the day. Joining us from Aberdeen, we have John Schaff. He's professor of political science at Northern State University. Welcome back, John.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Also on the phone, former South Dakota State Senator Tom Dempster. Tom, good to have you back as well. Tom Dempster, welcome. Thanks for being here. All right, John Schaff, we're going to start with some audio right away, because I want to talk about Governor Noem's, her conversations about how the media is treating her. And let's get into this overall narrative of how the virus has been handled by the governor and her staff in South Dakota. But we're going to begin with a quick clip from Breitbart News Daily podcast. The host here is Alex Marlowe. He's doing the interviewing. You'll hear his voice and Governor Kristi Noem's. This interview was posted on June 10th, and here he is asking her about her treatment in the media.
So of all my interests in the news, the number one is the weaponized nature of our establishment media right now. So you are someone who clearly had a successful approach, a approach that bucked the system. We just spoke to last hour Senator McSally, who has this incredible feminist arc, being a pioneering fighter pilot, and was someone who is an American hero and is pilloried by the press because she's on the right. Your experience was similar. You were one of the most effective governors, and I rarely read a positive story about how well you were handling it. In fact, I read negative stories, calling you naive, calling you all sorts of names, and every single one of these establishment media figures was proven incorrect.
You know, I served in our state legislature in South Dakota for 4 years, then spent 8 years in Congress, and now I've been governor for not quite 2 years. But, you know, I never had a war with the press. I never had conflict with the press. I certainly at times felt like they were not being fair. But what I've really realized the last 6 to 8 months is how manipulative they can be towards public perception. And I think they do a lot of it through what they choose to cover and what they choose not to cover. You know, they definitely spent a lot of time attacking and I would say really sensationalizing items and pulling out facts that worked for an agenda that they were trying to sell, and then rarely covering the good news of what was happening here in South Dakota. And that really is what is disturbing to me. I've spoken quite often about the press and how they are doing a grave disservice to the public by what they're doing by manipulating perceptions out there. And so I've just decided, the last several months that really telling the public about what I've been able to see and observe over the last 6 to 8 months is disturbing, and we should all be concerned about it.
Again, that's Governor Kristi Noem in an interview on Breitbart News Daily podcast here in June. John Schaaf, I'm going to ask you first. Her very specific words about the press being manipulative. This has changed. She said this is something new, that she's going to start pointing things out. What has changed, do you think?
Well, certainly her perception has changed. I think obviously what she's responding to is a couple things. So she's done various interviews. She was on the Breitbart show that you just played this from. She was on a Fox Business show recently, and the governor's office produced their own video that makes many of the points that she made in those other two interviews. And I think probably what is maybe under her skin a little bit is precisely that you saw states, and I think New York is the classic example, where results were far worse. And now, like, for example, about a week ago, the Wall Street Journal had a long article discussing all the policy failures of New York. But Andrew Cuomo was held up as this great hero for a short while other, you know, there were two articles I saw in the Minneapolis Star Tribune. I think there was one in the Washington Post. There was one in the Guardian. Even from England on South Dakota about this strange idea of not putting all sorts of restrictions in place and attacking Governor Noem for these things, like she was doing something not just a policy failure but something wicked. And I think as the policy differences have come about, how there are numerous policy failures in New York. Well, I was like, there was someone who writes for The Atlantic who said when Rick DeSantis in Florida was opening the beaches that he was literally killing people, and that hasn't happened, that maybe she's picking up something that the media was choosing to emphasize some things and not emphasize other things, and that there's kind of a preordained narrative that they were pushing. But there's certainly, I think, with this kind of this media strategy by Kristi Noem and her, I assume it's part of a team effort here. One doesn't get on all these shows by accident and produce, you know, well-produced videos by accident. That they're trying to push a couple narratives. One is that Kristi Noem did the right thing, that South Dakota is better off for her less aggressive response to COVID, that South Dakota has a way of life that's worth defending, and Kristi Noem will defend it. And thirdly, there's within that this attack on the media, which she feels, I think with some accuracy, turned her into a boogeyman, or I guess it would be boogeywoman, I suppose that would be, in this case, this figure of criticism. And she's reacting to that, and I think so. It's part of this overall strategy of trying to, I think, maybe I don't know, reintroduce Kristi Noem, both certainly to South Dakota, but also there's something to be said here that it seems like there's a national reach that she's trying to have, which is interesting.
Right, and you mentioned Governor Andrew Cuomo. Now New York City has 8.4 million people. South Dakota has 880,000. I'm getting those numbers slightly off, but you know, Governor Noem said from the beginning, and Tom Dempster, I want to bring you into this conversation now. She said from the beginning, we are not New York. And in interview after interview, she does point out the attention that Governor Cuomo has gotten for New York and the lack of storytelling about South Dakota. Tom, what do you want to say about the sort of the media strategy on a nationwide level of Governor Noem punching back and saying this narrative is not fair?
Well, I mean, Lori and John, I mean, it's really interesting. I don't know of a single politician that hasn't complained about about media treatment. If you're a surfer, you're going to complain about high waves. If you're a South Dakotan, you're going to complain about a long winter. It's just part and parcel. It's just part of the beast for sure. But as I listen to particularly the Breitbart interview, thank you, John, for that. But as I listen to that, it was Walter Mondale who said, you know, when you're in politics, you're always going to get a ton of snowballs, and it's your responsibility as a politician to take those snowballs, put a rock in the middle of the snowball, and return it. And Governor Noem's strategy, and she's very, very good at this. She's very good at judo, because when the media would say something, she's going to take that. She's going to take that alleged weakness and use it for her own strength. And she's taken that platform now with a national audience. I agree, John, as if one is seeking a national constituency, it takes the strength of the opponent, devours it, and makes it your own. It seems to me that on stations like Breitbart, a claim that the media is unfair to you or slanted in a certain direction is a bit like calling the pot black. But she's very good at taking the criticism and leveraging it and bouncing back from it and making it her strength. Watch and see.
John Schaaf mentioned this YouTube video that the governor's office produced, and it is entitled Lessons Learned from COVID-19. You can find it on YouTube, and we're going to play a little clip from that, John, and I ask you, because part of this, you know, a lot of people are trying to figure out if Governor Noem has a national political ambition, which she has been written about, and she has been pretty strong in saying, you know, I'm governor of South Dakota. And here's a little bit from that YouTube clip that kind of explains perhaps another strategy about why she's reaching out in a national way to highlight what's happening in the state.
To the builders, the producers, and the essential workers scattered throughout the country, if you've seen how South Dakota has managed this pandemic and you like what you've seen, come to South Dakota. To those professionals who will be working from home permanently, if you value our way of life, where people love freedom, smaller communities, and lots of wide open spaces, I want you to think about doing your work from a new home in South Dakota. And to business owners in other states who are frustrated that your business was forced to close, South Dakota has the friendliest tax and regulatory system in the nation. We didn't order businesses to close. We trusted them to innovate and to continue serving their customers. And we'd love for you to do your business here as well. South Dakota truly is open for business. Now, not all governors trusted their people, but I did. Different paths mean people have different choices, and South Dakota chose common sense solutions. If you want freedom, personal responsibility, and a government that works for you, rather than dictates to you, South Dakota is the place to get it.
John Schaaf, she says in one of the interviews that the state is getting phone calls or people who are interested in moving their businesses here or relocating here. Talk a little bit about this broader call to say, you know, she specifically mentions in her video that, you know, New York City and Silicon Valley might empty out a little bit. I'm not sure I've heard that anywhere else, but she says it's possible, and if so, consider South Dakota.
Well, you know, I think anyone who's done anything in sales, fundraising, or politics knows at a certain point you have to make the ask. Whether it's buy my product, make that donation, or vote for me, you have to make the ask. And I would say Kristi Noem is making the ask. When she said when she ran for governor, and Sheree has repeated it in this video that you just played, and then I think in the interview, I think with Breitbart, South Dakota is open for business, right? That's one of her catchphrases, and she is asking people, not covertly, it is overt, come to South Dakota and do business. If you want a certain way of life, South Dakota is, so what she's trying to do is make this response, her response to COVID, I think sort of bouncing off what Tom was saying. She, you know, she got criticized for some of this stuff. Now she's making it a virtue. Is that, hey, we do things differently here. And if you want low taxation, low regulation, and you know, a less urban way of life, South Dakota is the place to be. And she's not shy about saying that. And obviously this might be one reason why she's producing videos for YouTube, which, of course, can be seen by anybody, and going on national media, is that she's making this argument to the nation. And, you know, it might be for political purposes, but it could be if we want to be less cynical about it. It just, you know, sometimes people just mean what they say. And maybe what she really is doing is making the ask for South Dakota. Come here and live our way of life, and this way of life is a good way of life.
Tom Dempster, in the same YouTube video, she talks about going out with her family to the Black Hills and how there were license plates on cars from all over the country, and it's the most beautiful place, which sounds like a tourism ask as well. And, you know, a stark contrast to places that are shut down. She says, come here. Everybody else is. What are your thoughts about this message and the risks involved, Tom, of sort of declaring victory in a state that, you know, had to withstand the national scrutiny over the Smithfield plant? We've got fireworks coming up on the 4th of July. We've got a modified rally in Sturgis coming up. The national attention might be on her in the future. Is it too soon, Tom, to sort of declare that we've figured this out?
Well, yeah, just to step back a bit, I mean, very savvy, very smart, very articulate judo, for sure. My daughter lives in Los Angeles and just came home to South Dakota last night on a packed flight, by the way. Nobody in the mid-seat, but wasn't a spare seat on the airplane. When she told somebody in the Los Angeles airport where she was going, the response was, oh, I wish I could move there. But equally so, there were two people who sat behind her where the stewardess had to come and twice say, put on your masks. My daughter had two children with her. Both of them had their masks on 100% of the time. And they were abusive to my daughter, Jenny, for imposing those masks upon her. That's my worry. That's my concern. I think we're calling victory way too soon. Governor Noem was very candid in saying this is a marathon. This marathon, in everybody's opinion, is not over. What? We're maybe at our fourth or our fifth mile. We have many, many, many more miles to go. Not that anybody asked me, but I would love to say, I would love to hear something like, here in South Dakota, we take COVID seriously, and in the name of what, freedom and liberty and the personal responsibility that engenders, we wash our hands, we keep our distance, and we wear masks in public so we don't have to shut down our economy. I'm troubled when you take a look at statistics, when you take a look at studies about what happens when you reopen, when you look at the dramatic fall in our COVID cases that we in this country have not had. It's playing with fire.
And John Schaaf, earlier in that Breitbart conversation, we don't have that audio right now, but the host, Alex Marlowe, asks about masks and calls it a sort of the media decided masks were fashionable a few weeks into this, and then the narrative changes. And Governor Noem doesn't directly address that. She doesn't come back and say what she feels about masks after that question. But there is certainly this sort of you know, back and forth about what does a mask stand for, John. And I also want to ask you, John Schaaf, you know, you can expand on that or this idea of what the national media story should be, especially including places like New York where there are policy failures and successes. You know, the Columbia University, which is in New York, that report that they released saying, you know, tens of thousands of lives could have been saved if social distancing measures had been implemented just a few weeks sooner. And you remember President Trump called them a liberal, disgraceful institution. So John, what does she want the national media to be covering?
Well, this is what I mean is that you know, you have various narratives. And there's a reason why institutions are held in disrepute. And so, for example, we now know, because Dr. Fauci admitted it yesterday, that he basically said, yes, we lied to America when we said you don't need to wear masks and masks actually don't help because we were afraid that people would buy up all the masks and medical professionals wouldn't be able to get them. Instead of saying medical professionals need these masks, even though they help, please don't buy them up, they chose to tell an untruth to the American people. And so you can forgive people for being somewhat angry when there was a time when, you know, the WHO and the national government said masks don't help, and now there's kind of a social stigma behind not wearing a mask. Well, that's two different things, and so people are going to be distrustful. And so people are going to be distrustful when, you know, when someone like Andrew Cuomo is held up as a hero, and, you know, within a week of closing down New York, he, the mayor of New York, the health commissioner of New York City, were saying, go out, go to plays, go to Chinese New Year festivals. There's nothing to worry about. And then, within, say, 3 weeks, the exact opposite is happening. And so I don't think that anybody has held themselves up within this crisis and ensuing crisis like political disorder and, you know, protests and riots. It seems like there's nobody who acts, whether it's politicians or news media, in a trustworthy, straightforward way, that everybody, whether it's Andrew Cuomo, Kristi Noem, maybe Donald Trump, they've got their agenda, and sticking to that agenda is more important than telling the people what they need to hear. And in this case, I'd say probably Kristi Noem has done better than most national politicians, though, like Tom, I think we talked about this many weeks ago when we had we're reopened for, I forget what was the catchphrase now, that when we were reopening, 5-6 weeks ago.
Back
to normal. And my point then was, how about back to less weird? Because we don't really want to go back to normal, as Tom says. And sometimes that message is missing, that these aren't normal times.
And I'm wondering, John, though, about, and we need to move on to policing if we're going to make sure that we cover that a little bit here with what's happening in Sioux Falls. But the idea of saying, you know, the national media agenda is sort of like lumping Cuomo and Noem in the same bucket and saying they're politicians. They've behaved very differently. Governor Noem closed schools before Governor Cuomo did. Throwing out the word national media or establishment media or the press or the media and saying they have an agenda and they're manipulating the narrative seems patently unfair to me, John.
Yet on the other hand, we know that national media is a small number of people. They are in a very geographically centered thing. We know, I was just reading this in the new book by Joel Kotkin, The Urbanist, they like 50% of national media people graduate from a very small handful of universities, right? And we know that we have all sorts of data on the national media that they are very unrepresentative of the public. They have views that are very unrepresentative of the general public. And, you know, the social psychologist John Hyatt says there's one finding from psychology that is ironclad. You put people together who think alike, they will become more extreme than any individual member. And so when you've got a media that lives in very small geographic entities that has almost monolithic views on the world, who graduated from a small number of universities, that they are going to become more extreme than any individual member. And I don't think it's incorrect to say that it's a generalization, which in some cases will be false, but I think you can generally say that national media tends to have a certain view of the world, and that view ends up being portrayed in how they report the news.
Tom, well, how does it impact her relationship with local media? The constant saying that, you know, the press manipulates perceptions. Meanwhile, you live in a state and you represent the people from a certain state, and those journalists are responsible for reporting on you. Does this do damage to her relationship with the local press to spend so much time on national conservative outlets like Breitbart and Fox, and to slam how she's portrayed in the press so ardently? When people here in the state are covering South Dakota people's lives every day?
Whole different story. I mean, absolutely, cable and the internet has devoured the authority of what the New York Times used to have, of what the Washington Post used to have. It used to be CBS News, where Walter Cronkite would say, that's the way it is.
well, that's kind of not the way it is anymore. Every media, every we've kind of gone back to where we were in the late 1900s, early 1900s, where newspapers, the Estelle Republican, whatever, named themselves after ideologies. Absolutely, Breitbart is that. South Dakota, I mean, I hearken back to the days, when we had the Wooster brothers, when we had the Steve Youngs, when we had the Dave Kranz. All of them were equally as skilled as, I don't know if you've heard of her, were equally as skilled and as good as Lori Walsh about asking questions. They're penetrating questions. They're good questions, and you never got away with anything. We have four or five maybe reporters in the South Dakota that are still like that. It's awful nice to see what South Dakota News Watch. I mean, that harkens back to maybe the older days of journalism. I'm wondering, and I'm not certain what my point is, but I mean, I've always looked at the media as a fourth estate. They've always been my friend because they are, as a politician, they were doing exactly the same thing that I was trying to do to make this a better place to be. Never looked at them as the enemy, but would often call a member of the news media and say the story that she did about me was unfair. I just want you to know that.
Very briefly, before I let you go, let's touch base on policing in South Dakota and how that conversation is going. And we'll really just get the tip of the iceberg here. But this morning, Chief Matt Burns addressed the press in Sioux Falls, talking about reviewing policies in light of the protests and the events in Minneapolis where an officer killed George Floyd while he was in police custody. And here is how Chief Burns started out with their overview of what the Sioux Falls Police Department has been looking into regarding policy.
Since the tragic and senseless death of George Floyd in Minneapolis on May 25th, our department has undertaken a specific review of 8 key areas of our policy to ensure that they are in compliance with the law, best practices in our profession, and frankly, the expectations of the community we serve. These areas are the subject of police policy reform discussions nationally, and it is important to let everyone know that our policies are consistent with these discussions. The residents and visitors to our city can be assured that our officers' efforts to serve and protect them rest on a sound and responsible foundation. These 8 key areas are de-escalation techniques, chokeholds, also known as strangleholds, warning before shooting, exhausting reasonable alternatives before using deadly force, duty to intervene, shooting at moving vehicles, use of force continuum, and comprehensive reporting. I am pleased to inform you that our policies stand up well in these discussions, are lawful, and they're appropriate. I encourage anyone with questions about these or any policies of our department to either review them at the city website of siouxfalls.org or please contact us directly.
Again, that's the voice of Sioux Falls Police Chief Matt Burns addressing policing in South Dakota. And shortly after that, he was asked a question by a journalist in the room about a community advisory council and whether or not for complaints, because when you make a complaint in the Sioux Falls Police Department and the Minnehaha County Sheriff's Department, it goes to that officer's supervisor, Matt Burns said, and someone asked about a community advisory council. And here he listened to his response.
There is at the state level, there is the Law Enforcement Standards and Training Commission, which oversees the certification of officers across the state level. But as far as Sioux Falls, that is something that we're looking at as a part of a potential reform effort going forward.
How soon could something like that come into play?
Well, that kind of depends on the group that you draw from. I think that's something that's very reasonable, and that we're going to study that. I don't want to put a timeline on it because there's a lot of factors that go into that.
So, John, the question here is the Sioux Falls Police Department, you know, looking at policy, saying, we're very happy and pleased to report that, all is well. And then when someone digs into a question, there's a little more hesitation about whether or not they're really prepared to think about community advisory groups or what will go forward. My question to you and Tom, briefly before we let you go, is, is the Sioux Falls Police Department understand what protesters are asking for? Are they missing the point or are they on the right track here?
Well, I think in response to protests over the last handful of weeks, I think the police force has done what you want them to do, which is review what they're doing. And partially they're going to have to respond
to state initiatives. I don't know if you're aware. Well, yesterday, the president released an executive order, which now the Department of Justice is going to be putting out some regulations on local police forces that local police forces will have to respond to. I think that's a step in the right direction. I don't. From what I heard, is the chief is not saying no to a community board. It sounds like he's not saying yes yet. But I don't know. I have no opinion on community boards. I can't imagine an argument against them. But I also haven't thought about it much. But I also don't know that it's the sine qua non of reform that you must have community boards. But also, it seems like it's a reasonable request.
Tom Dempster, before we let you go, anything that you think law enforcement agencies and South Dakota police agencies are going to really need to be looking hard at in the days ahead as far as making changes? Or do you think they're just sort of waiting for things to go back to less weird?
I don't think so. I mean, one of the things that I enjoy about the mayor is his ability to stand in front of a microphone. And frankly, to show a little bit of angst, to show a little bit of uncertainty, but certainly to show concern. I trust that kind of response. I trust that we don't have all the answers, but we are certainly experiencing this pain along with every resident in Sioux Falls, and that we will do everything that we possibly can to find and seek the cure. We don't have ready answers. Ready answers are not easy. We've only lived with this for some 350 years, and we'll continue to live with this. Our dreams not quite being realized that everybody is equal. I think the angst can, the visible angst and pain can help us solve some problems.
Now that's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. Again, if you're looking for an individual segment from our radio program, you can find all of our segments at listen.sdpb.org or by following the In the Moment Segments podcast. And if you have a story idea, send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. For Lori Walsh and Chris Loffrey, I'm Josh Heyer. Thank you for listening.